Hi. If I could have your attention, please, we're going to get started. Wonderful. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests. My name is Katrina Gong, and as one of the co-presidents of the Oslo Society, along with Ryan Hartley, this year, we'd like to welcome you all to the 38th Annual Osler Lecture, organized by the Department of Social Studies of Medicine and hosted here at McGill University's Faculty of Medicine. Please note that this lecture tonight will be filmed and that there is a photographer present. It is my honor and absolute pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. E. Fuller-Torrey. Tonight, Dr. Torrey will be describing how new insights on the workings of the brain have fundamentally changed how we perceive and treat one of psychiatry's most serious disorders, schizophrenia. Dr. Torrey was born in Utica, New York, and knew, like many of us, from a young age that he wanted to become a doctor. He earned his undergraduate degree at Princeton University, graduating magna cum laude in 1953. It was during this tenure at Princeton, when his sister Rhoda was diagnosed with schizophrenia, that Dr. Torrey decided to dedicate his life to helping those who, like Rhoda, were afflicted with psychiatric disorders. At that time in the 50s, when Freudian theory still prevailed in mainstream psychiatry, Rhoda's illness was mainly attributed to traumatic childhood events and poor parenting. Reflecting on his similar childhood then, Dr. Torrey wondered why he hadn't developed schizophrenia too. Challenging prevailing views, he would go on to spearhead a movement to change how we understand and treat mental illness. Dr. Torrey studied medicine at McGill University. He then earned a master's degree in anthropology while completing his residency of psychiatry at Stanford. He first practiced medicine as a Peace Corps physician in Ethiopia before returning to the United States, serving communities in the South Bronx and in Alaska. From 1970 to 1975, he worked with the director of the National Institute of Mental Health, after which he served as a staff psychiatrist at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C. Here, he specialized in the treatment of severe mental illnesses. In Washington, Dr. Torrey also began to research the medical and neurological causes of psychiatric diseases, research that increasingly suggested that schizophrenia was indeed a disease of the brain. The advent of imaging technologies such as MRI and PET scans provided tangible scientific evidence that schizophrenia causes changes in the brains and helped dislodge Freudian theories regarding the causes of mental illness. Dr. Fuller's neurobiological research not only helped transform scientific thinking, it also helped families touched by mental illness, many of whom were blamed for their children's diseases. Dr. Torrey's books, Surviving Schizophrenia, published first in 1983, became an invaluable guide for families looking for answers and for support. And as Laurie Flynn, the executive director of the National Alliance of the Mentally Ill, stated at the time, he spoke for us when no one in the medical community would. As Dr. Torrey's advocacy and research efforts became more prominent, the founders of the Stanley Medical Research Institute asked him to become its first executive director in 1989. This nonprofit organization has since funded more than $550 million in research in more than 30 countries. The Institute supports clinical trials for biological therapies for schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, and maintains a brain bank that supplies much-needed specimens to labs all over the world. Since the mid-1990s, the focus of Dr. Torrey's research has shifted from monozygotic twin studies to identifying viruses and infections that may increase one's risk of developing schizophrenia. Dr. Torrey has received many other prestigious awards in his career, including multiple commendation medals from the U.S. Public Health Service and the Research Award from the International Congress of Schizophrenia. More recently, in 1998, Dr. Torrey founded the Treatment Advocacy Center, a nonprofit organization dedicated to eliminating barriers to the timely and effective treatment for severe mental illnesses. The organization promotes laws, policies, and practices to deliver psychiatric care and develop new treatments for severe and persistent psychiatric illnesses. He remains a board member to this day. Currently, Dr. Torrey also serves as the Associate Director of the Stanley Medical Research Institute and is Professor of Psychiatry at the Uniformed Services University of Health Sciences. In his career, he has written more than 20 books, more than 200 lay and scientific papers, and has written for many newspapers, including the New York Times and Wall Street Journal. He has also made multiple appearances on national radio and television shows, including 60 Minutes and Oprah. So, please join me in giving a warm welcome to tonight's Osler lecturer, Dr. Torrey.
Thank you very much, Katrina, for your very kind introduction on it. Sounds like I should be on lithium. I also want to thank Dean Edelman and Andrea Tone for the invitation to come and speak to you all tonight. It's always a pleasure to come back to McGill, especially on warm days in November, which I'm sure you get lots of now. When I was here, we didn't used to, but now I guess weather's changed, so you're in much better shape. I would like to have you believe that I understood the importance of William Osler from my very first days here. I can tell you it's not true. It was something to do with a library, an Osler library, but other than that, my main occupation for the first 2 years was surviving and trying to remember which muscles are inserted where on the tibia and the fibula and everything else, and Osler didn't quite fit in my pattern at that time. By the time I was in third and fourth year, I knew he was important, but I remember being told that he's like the Rocket Richard of medical education. And I thought, well, you know, it's kind of a Canadian thing. And then several years after that, we opened our laboratory at Johns Hopkins looking at infectious agents in schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, and I was going to Hopkins on a daily, on a weekly basis. Suddenly I realized Osler was very important over there too, so I started to look into it a little bit. And I realized that he really was the Rocket Richard of medical education. What I'm going to do this evening a little bit, Osler was obviously very prominent in the history of medicine. Part of the history of medicine is the history of diseases and how we understand diseases. I'm going to focus a little bit on schizophrenia in a way that you probably won't have heard before. And my models are some excellent recent publications, Mukherjee's book on the emperor and the cancer book, Dubose's White Plague, books on influenza, etc. The history of diseases, and this is the history of schizophrenia as a disease on it. And I want you to think in terms of some of the things I'm going to be describing of how they're relevant for how we understand what's wrong with people who have schizophrenia today. So that, for example, why are we having so much trouble figuring out how to treat the people that we discharge from Douglas Hospital, as we call it, Verdun in my day on it. Why we have such confused laws, especially in Ontario, as to when you can treat people involuntarily in terms of how you understand what's wrong with them. Individual cases like the fellow who killed a sports writer in Ontario, clearly psychotic, and yet a few years later he's turning up on the border trying to get in the United States completely psychotic again. I mean, how are we treating these people? What are we doing on it? Also places like British Columbia back in the early 90s, I did a study across British Columbia at that time. It had the best services of anywhere in North America, certainly better than any state and better than any province as far as I knew, in terms of treating people with severe mental illness and what you do with it. And yet today it's gone downhill terribly. It's really not much better than any of the other provinces or most of the states. How do we understand it? How does that kind of a thing happen on it? Finally, let me just say in introduction that although I talk specifically about schizophrenia, I'm reasonably convinced now, and I think the evidence is increasing, that we're really talking about psychosis as a spectrum. Most of what I'm going to say is true of bipolar with psychotic features, some also of severe depression, major depression with psychotic features. And there seems to be a spectrum across the psychosis spectrum. So that, but I'll focus just on schizophrenia, but I don't want you to think that that's just what the only thing that's included on it. Okay, why strange? Strange disease. Roy Porter says, strangeness has typically been the key feature in the fractured dialogue that go on between the mad and the sane. Madness is like a foreign country. Sigmund Freud, I do not like these patients. I feel them to be so far distant from me and from everything human, a curious sort of intolerance which surely makes me unfit to be a psychiatrist. In fact, that's true. He wasn't a bad psychotherapist, but he wasn't much of a psychiatrist. But the important thing I want you to remember is that it is the disease that is strange, not the person. This is my sister, developed schizophrenia when she was 17, just almost 18. And the one thing she loved to do most when she was 15 and 16 years old was go shopping. And even when she was then 60, 65 years old, she's deceased now, is when she was very psychotic at times, I could always get her attention by saying, let's go shopping. She'd always want to go shopping. She was exactly the same person, even with psychosis on top of it. But the person underneath was there. The person didn't change. Louis Balzac wrote a very nice short story on Louis Lambert, called Louis Lambert, where his wife is talking about him. No doubt Louis appears to be insane, but he is not so. He wings his way through the spaces of thought with the agility of a swallow. Yet I can follow him in all of his circlings. This is the history of so-called madness on it. Strangeness of schizophrenia, it's a principal reason why it is such a problematic disease, why it's stigmatized by the public, why it's ignored by many professionals, grossly under-researched, misunderstood by the legal profession, and inappropriately treated. And we will talk about some of those things on it. Major source of strangeness is the fact that schizophrenia affects the areas of the brain that are affected that have evolved most recently. Awareness of self, awareness of others, introspection. This is really the origin. This is what makes the disease fascinating and also what makes it so difficult to treat and so difficult to understand on it. Well, what do we know about the evolution of the brain? How do we know which areas evolved first? Fleischig, a German neuroanatomist, did a very nice study years ago. It's not widely known. Divided the brain into 45 areas based on myelination at birth. What he did is he took newborns who had died from one reason or another and then looked at the degree of myelination of all the areas of the brain and then divided up into 45 areas. These are not the I'm not very good technologically here. Got it. Okay. Divided into 45 areas. These are the 45 areas. And anybody who is spending a lot of time looking at schizophrenia in areas of the brain will recognize some of these areas look very familiar because the areas that are in yellow here are the areas that evolved most recently. These were least myelinated and the study he did on it. Now, these are not the Brodmann areas. These are the Fleischig areas, but I put the Brodmann areas over to the right. These are the 37 to 45 was the last evolved areas of the brain, and the Brodmann area equivalent is on the right. But anyone who has been looking at a lot of the neuroanatomy of schizophrenia recently will recognize that many of these areas are exactly the areas we're looking at primarily in schizophrenia, especially frontal pole, dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, anterior cingulate, the two parts of the inferior parietal area, the angular gyrus and the supramarginal gyrus, the insula. These are the areas which are associated with the most recently evolved cognitive abilities of humans, including thinking about ourselves, thinking about what other people think about ourselves, etc. What this also says is there is no such thing as an animal model of schizophrenia. Anybody who says they have an animal model of schizophrenia, be very skeptical. There are animal models for various symptoms, but there's no such animal model because no animal except humans get schizophrenia. Even chimps cannot get this because there are parts of the brain, many of these are not evolved sufficiently in them. So once you get the strangeness and the symptoms of schizophrenia, this is the outline of what I'm going to be talking about now. Strangeness and our understanding of the causes, how to treat it, and why the future looks bright. And it does indeed look bright. Okay, strangeness and symptoms. We have two categories of symptoms in schizophrenia. One are the symptoms that are able to be understood. These are not strange. And the second are the symptoms that are not able to be understood. What do I mean by able to be understood, not strange? Auditory hallucinations, depression, flattening of emotions, withdrawal, feelings of being watched. We all have those things, especially now, feelings of being watched by the government. But even auditory hallucinations, lots of people have minor auditory hallucinations. These are not that different on it. Some of my European colleagues have been focusing on this recently on it, thinking that your deceased grandmother is, you heard her warn you about something, whatever on it. We can all understand these to some extent. Now, severe auditory hallucinations are almost by definition schizophrenia, but minor auditory hallucinations or thinking you're hearing things, it's not unusual at all. It's continuum auditory hallucinations, something like hypertension from mild to very severe. But people with severe auditory hallucinations have schizophrenia or bipolar with psychotic features or major depression with psychotic features until proven otherwise. Now, the symptoms that are more interesting are the symptoms that are not able to be understood. These are strange. This is what makes the disease seem strange. Fragmented thought patterns, disconnected, loose associations. I used to have, when I was working in the hospital, I had a fellow who was on my ward who would come down every day and dictate to my secretary. He's pretty good at it, too. He'd dictate various thoughts. This is the kind of thing he would dictate. Write all kinds of black snakes, looking like raw onion, high-strung, deep-down, long-winded, all kinds of sizes. Well, you get a sense of kind of what he's trying to talk about there, but it's pretty strange. Secondly is bizarre and fixed delusions. Now, again, we all tend to have some delusions, grandiose or otherwise, but the really bizarre delusions is Marion Carey, who was killed by the police when she was trying to run up toward the Capitol last year, believed that President Obama had put her under electronic surveillance and it was being fed to all the national news outlets. Well, that's pretty weird. Altered sense of self. Say, that's odd. How can you have an altered sense of self? We all know what ourselves are. And yet body image disorders are quite common in schizophrenia. And these have been well described by John Cutting in England. Kinds of examples he used. I have no contact with myself. I feel almost like a zombie. I am almost non-existent. We know that out-of-body experiences can be produced by lesions in the parietal lobe, so these are something we can understand. Fourth, altered pain threshold. This also is quite upsetting when you have patients like this, and I've had patients like this. This was observed by Haslam, Kreplin, Bloiler, and there's lots of histories in the early 20th century, late 19th century, perforated ulcer or appendix fractures, breast abscess, brain areas that are associated with this is parts of the brain that we know are involved in pain and also involved in schizophrenia, thalamus, insula, posterior cingulate, parietal. When you see a patient like this, you really, it's very, very striking. I had one patient, for example, a woman who had been on the ward for quite a while and was going out to work one day. She had a job on the grounds, and I noticed she had very large wet area on her breast, and I said, let's take a look at that. She had a huge breast abscess, and I had treated breast abscesses, and they tend to be very painful for women. She denied she had had any pain whatsoever on it. We had another patient who had gone into Sears, bought a circular saw, electric saw, gone in the woman's room and sawed her leg off. This is strange. And there's lots of literature on this. Self-mutilations, mentally ill inmate gouges out own eyes, man shoots self in head with crossbow, Woman cuts off own leg with electric saw. Man severs own neck with chainsaw. This last one was one of the first brains that collected in our brain collection. A fellow had actually taken a saw and put it on his neck and cut his head off on it. This is hard to understand because we don't have anything really that, in terms of our thinking, that can help us understand that. And one of the most strange symptoms is anosognosia, the inability to understand that there's anything wrong with you, decreased awareness of illness. We're not talking about denial. This is an anatomical as opposed to a psychological change. It occurs in some strokes, especially right parietal. It's been described actually for 100 years by the neurologists. Alzheimer's disease gets it. Huntington's disease in later stages gets it. It occurs in about 50% of individuals with schizophrenia and about 40% bipolar with psychotic features on it. And it often worsens as the disease progresses. In the early stages, people with anosognosia often are aware of it. President Reagan, for example, announced his own Alzheimer's disease, and yet 3-4 years later, he couldn't even recognize his family members on it, totally unaware. I mean, it's one of the few good things about Alzheimer's disease is after the early stages, you don't know you have it because you don't want to know you have it. John Hinckley, who is the one who shot Reagan, just as he was starting to develop schizophrenia, and indeed he does have still schizophrenia, he wrote a letter to his family saying, "I don't know what's the matter. Things are not going well. I think there's something wrong with my head." And that's not too uncommon. I have a woman who I knew whose son lived in Palo Alto, whose son, when he was 16, was developing the very earliest stages of schizophrenia. He would go down to the Stanford Medical Library and did all the research on it before anybody realized he had it. And yet, you know, 5 years later, he was totally unaware of it, had lost all of that awareness of illness. Now, about half the people with schizophrenia never develop this. It depends on the part of the brain that's affected. Here's Oliver Sacks' take on anosognosia. It is not only difficult, it is impossible for patients with certain right hemisphere syndromes to know that their own problems, a peculiar and specific anosognosia, as Babinski called it. And it is singularly difficult for even the most sensitive observer to picture the inner state, the situation of such patients, for this is almost unimaginably remote from anything he himself has ever known. It's quite extraordinary, the descriptions of this in the literature, where you go in and say, "Mrs. Jones, I understand you have paralysis of your left leg." She says, "No, I don't have, doctor. I don't understand why." It's a college-educated woman. "I don't understand why everybody comes in and says that. There's nothing wrong with my left leg." Well, could you move your left leg for me, Mrs. Jones? Said, "Well, you know, it's tired now. Why don't you come back later and maybe I can move it then?" There's even a description of a fellow who had a stroke that affected the right parietal area, but also some of the occipital area, and he was blind, but he was not aware he was blind. So, as described in the 1890s, you would ask him, "Can you see this in front of me?" And say, "No, there's nothing wrong with my eyes, but you just need to turn the lights on." So he was unaware that he actually was blind on it. It's very hard for us to imagine anything like that. It's very hard for us to imagine people who have a acute psychosis who have no understanding that there's anything wrong with them. I've been told at least 100 times, "Doc, there's nothing wrong with me. If you really want to help me, call a CIA or the IRA or the KGB or whoever it is and just tell them to stop sending these voices in my head." This is a very, very common syndrome on it. We now have 20 studies, neuroimaging studies of the brains of individuals with schizophrenia who have anosognosia, with and without anosognosia. Almost every one of them have shown some structural abnormalities, including a group down in Toronto, the University of Toronto, that have done some nice work on this as well. And two of the positive studies included individuals who had never been treated. So people who deny things like anosognosia will usually say, "Well, this is probably just a medication effect." It's not just a medication effect. This is depending on exactly the part of the brain that is affected with the disease. This is one of the studies that has been done showing that there are differences in the perfusion of the precuneus, posterior parietal, superior parietal, and there's also, for the first time, a Russian study that used some of our brains from our brain collection, where we had a very rough estimate of the people based on the history that I got when we had the postmortem brains obtained them, whether or not they were aware of their illness. And this is the group in Moscow who actually showed a postmortem difference on it that reduced oligodendrocytes and the density in the inferior parietal lobule, the lack correlated with the lack of insight, lack of awareness, and anosmia and schizophrenia on it. This is a study I was just talking about. 15 individuals with fair or poor awareness compared to 9 with good awareness had a 21% decrease in the oligodendrocytes and the angular gyrus, BA39 on it, one of the areas that we're most interested in on it. These are the areas of the brain that appear to be have a great deal to do with anosognosia, especially on the right side, inferior parietal, superior parietal, and pecuneus, medial frontal, and anterior cingulate on it. So we know pretty much now the areas of the brain that are involved that produce the anosognosia, and presumably people with schizophrenia who have excellent awareness of their illness, and some do indeed, and good understanding of it, probably have different areas of their brain that are affected because, as I'll talk about in a few minutes, schizophrenia is not a disease of a single part of the brain. It's a network disease, and that's part of the problem of understanding it. It also leads to major legal problems because lawyers don't understand this at all. In fact, in my experience, lawyers don't understand much of anything. I'm a little biased along those lines. This is even 1869. Generally insane persons do not regard themselves as insane and consequently can see no reason for the confinement other than the malevolent designs of those who have deprived them of their liberty. We are still fighting this today. Many in the civil liberties group, people who oppose the kinds of things I've been trying to do in the States, say that anosognosia does not exist and that we should never involuntarily hospitalize anybody who doesn't agree to hospitalization, and usually ends up this paragraph calling me a Nazi, which is quite common. Anosognosia, the consequences. So if our failure to understand anosognosia and our failure to treat people who should be treated, even though we clearly have clearly diagnosed them, clearly identified them as sick, this is some of the consequences, and this is what we're facing in the States. Facing it a little bit in Canada also. Each one of these people were clearly diagnosed. Jared Loughner in Tucson was even diagnosed by one of his people that he was talking on the internet on it. And one of the people said, on the basis of what you're saying, I think you have schizophrenia and you need to get some help. So he was even diagnosed by the people he was talking with. James Holmes, clearly diagnosed. Alexis, no question about it. So if we fail to treat people who are clearly diagnosed and in need of treatment, this is what we can expect. And we've gotten very good at this in the United States. We now have one of these every month, roughly. And people are starting for the first time to say, hey, there's something wrong here. Maybe we should do something different. Okay, strangers to our understanding of the disease. 19th century theories, genes, intemperance, immorality, poverty, wealth, urbanization, railway travel, uterine excitement, tight lacing, socialist lectures. Socialist lectures will do it every time. I especially like railway travel. When it came in the 1840s, the theory was, because there was some belief that insanity was increasing quite rapidly at that time, as I'll come back to in a minute. They said, you know, the problem is with the railways is you sit there and the track wasn't very good, so your head goes back and forth, and that's clearly causing the insanity on it. It's pretty good theory. So what do we have? 20th century, we have Ronald Lang saying schizophrenia is a state of reality, cyclic in nature, by which the self renews itself. Zoss, sort of myth. Bateson, a way of dealing with double-bind situations. Lids, skewed or schismatic families. Mosier, disturbed or disturbing behavior. Peter Bregan, a failure of nerve. Now, these are not really kooky people. Lauren Mosier, when I was first at the National Institutes of Mental Health, was in charge of the schizophrenia research there. Litz was a full professor at Yale. But I must say, I think that railway travel was quite a bit closer than any of these theories were. So what do we know about the causes of schizophrenia now? We know it is a brain disease. There are gross and microscopic structural abnormalities. There are hundreds of these studies in the literature now. Caught up with myself here. And the best study is done on 771 drug naive. So we're not dealing, drugs do also cause changes in the brain. So if you really want to do these studies well, you've got to do them on people before they've been treated, where they're drug naive. This is an article in the Schizophrenia Bulletin from 2 years ago, very nice article, showing of these 771 drug naive, what on a meta-analysis, what do you expect to see? First was total, backwards here. I'm trying to go backwards and it's going forwards. I'm screwing it up. There's the problem. Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah, it's because I was hitting that thing. It's too high tech for me. These arrows are very confusing. So it is a brain disease. This is from that study. Total brain volume decreased. Total gray matter decreased. Total white matter decreased. Hippocampus decreased in size. Thalamus decreased. So there's no question that there's structural differences. They're subtle. It's not like Alzheimer's disease. It's subtle. Neuropsychological abnormalities, there are literally several hundred of these studies on it. Never treated people drug naive, just as impaired as those who have not been treated or who have been treated on it. Especially attention, executive function. Psychologists love these. There's a whole, I think, several hundred psychologists now making their living just doing these kinds of studies with funding from NIMH and other places on it. Neurological abnormalities. I started doing some of these studies on my patients back in the 70s. It's actually very impressive. There's over 70 studies now looking at drug-naive patients, including 30 on drug-naive patients. And it's not, of course, gross neurological signs. It's what we call a soft signs. For example, I would have my patient give me their hand and say, close your eyes on the back of my pen. I'm going to write a number on the palm of your hand, and I want you to tell me what the number was. Well, people with various kinds of brain damage, not specific to schizophrenia, have trouble turning the number around in their brain and being able to give you the number. This is an example of soft sign on it. 50 to 60% of patients show abnormalities in the soft signs. Another kind of neurological abnormalities are the EEG abnormalities, eye signs, evoked potentials, etc. Neurochemical abnormalities, you all know about these and you hear about them all the time. We got lots of them. You name it, and it's been found to be abnormal on it. Infectious abnormalities, this is part of the research I'm very much involved in. These have been reported early, even in the 20th century. Lymphocyte abnormalities, C-reactive protein, which we're looking at very seriously now. Increased antibodies against various infectious agents, which is what I spend a lot of my time doing on it. Now, the implications of our failure to understand schizophrenia as a brain disease are really very serious, and that's where we get into the kind of trouble we have. NIMH, for about 20 years, did almost no research on schizophrenia. And then when Dr. Tom Insel came in 2002, it got turned around, and he's actually done a very good job. Some of us then publicized their failure to do this kind of research. We identified in one series, 1 year, they had 18 grants allocated for research on how pigeons think. How pigeons think is kind of interesting, but not in place of severe mental illness on it. But they actually knew much more about bird brains than they did about human brains on it. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration is the main federal agency in the United States that is in charge of mental illness. Whatever the federal government does on mental illness, does not acknowledge that schizophrenia is a brain disease, No mention of schizophrenia or bipolar in its current three-year planning document of 40,000 words. The primary expert on schizophrenia that uses, a fellow named Dr. Daniel Fisher, who believes that schizophrenia is a severe emotional distress and a spiritual experience on it. Okay. Secondly, what do we know? It's not a genetic disease, but rather has multiple predisposing genes. This is actually the single biggest advance in the last decade, is that schizophrenia is not a true genetic disease. There are no genes of major effect, but really now 200 genes of minor effect, and probably a lot more than that. So schizophrenia is similar to diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, many cancers, etc., where you have a genetic predisposition involving many, many genes, but it's not a genetically caused disease. This has been a major problem for my colleagues, many of my genetic colleagues, most of whom are on antidepressants now, because of the failure of these massive studies of genes in hundreds and hundreds of patients. And they kept saying, well, you know, we only got 100 patients. If we just get 300 patients, we'll be able to show it. And they got 300 patients. Well, no, now we need really 600 patients. Just keeps going up. We get the same thing. There's just multiple genes of very minor effect on it. The fact that it's not a genetic disease is consistent with other aspects of this disease. Concordance rate among MZ twins is really only 30 to 35%, despite what your books say. Very low rate of reproduction. This is a Finnish study. Males had 27% reproduction rate, males with schizophrenia. Females only 45%, so they're not reproducing themselves. Don't forget, between 1850 and 1950, we put everybody down there in places like Douglas and in the state hospitals in the United States. The patients with the most severe forms of the disease were hospitalized and unable to reproduce. And yet the incidence of schizophrenia increased during that time. So it's a very odd disease, that the fewer reproductions you have, the higher the incidence goes on it. And then the one thing that I published a paper on several years ago, between 1939 and 1945, Nazi Germany killed at least 75% of all hospitalized patients with schizophrenia. And yet following the war in 1965, the first studies that were done on the incidence of schizophrenia in Germany, it had increased on it. So again, this is something that's very difficult to understand by any kind of traditional genetic. And let me say that the fact that schizophrenia is not a genetic disease is actually good news. What it means is that eugenics was wrong. What it means is that the Cold Spring Harbor, the sterilization laws, all of those were based on the fact that they believed that schizophrenia and psychosis generally, insanity, was a genetic disease. 1934 to 1945, in Germany, 130,000 people with schizophrenia were sterilized and about 100,000 were killed on it. So I think that it's unfortunate if you're a traditional geneticist and have put your whole career on the genetics of schizophrenia, saying that once we identify these genes, and that's what a lot of my colleagues have said, we can all go home because we'll be there. But it's not true. But it's important to remember that there's a really good side to this as well on it. Main findings of the recent genetic studies, by far the strongest genetic findings has been on 6P21, the HLA complex, that the immune infectious area is activated in people with schizophrenia. Suggests immune function is centrally involved. In fact, this has been one of the major findings that has led the field and generally to go back and look at inflammation and immune function in schizophrenia, which has been very productive so far. Research on schizophrenia should not look only at genes, but rather at genes interacting with infectious and other environmental agents on it. We know that. So what do we know about the causes of schizophrenia? Is a brain disease, has some unusual epidemiological characteristics on it. Number one, there's a seasonal pattern to the birth. Very few diseases have a seasonal pattern. The most marked ones are things like rubella and are related to things. Schizophrenia has a 6 to 8% increase in late winter and early spring There are about 200 studies on this. Very low odds ratio, about 1.07. So you have to look at not just a few people, and has no reflections on your mother-in-law because she was born in the spring. You have to look at hundreds of people and actually to be able to show this. But it's remarkably replicable in large in the southern hemisphere. Although you got smaller ends in the southern hemisphere because fewer people live in Australia and New Zealand. But it's exactly what you would expect. It's also late winter, early spring by southern hemisphere standards on it. Secondly, fascinating. If you are born in an urban area or raised in an urban area, you are more likely to develop schizophrenia than if you are born in or raised in a rural area. This has been replicated many times now. Again, should give us some clues in terms of what we're looking at. Pretty good odds ratio, 2.24. And it's also suburban area is halfway between urban area and the rural area. And it also depends if you take, and much of this work was done in Denmark where they have the database where you can do this. If you take people when they moved as a young child from the rural area to the urban area, they acquire the increased incidence and the other way around. So it works like the multiple sclerosis one does. Excess case among immigrants. This is much more widely known, but it's not just from anywhere. It's from Jamaica to England or from Morocco to the Netherlands, but it's not among all immigrants, it's just among some immigrant groups. But the most interesting thing, not only do your first generation immigrants have an increased risk, but your second generation immigrant, the people who were actually born in England or born in the Netherlands, have an even greater risk on it. And you say, well, people with schizophrenia are more likely to emigrate. In fact, it's the other way around, that people have looked at this, people with schizophrenia are less likely to emigrate on it. So again, it's a clue that something's going on environmentally. Rheumatoid arthritis. 16 studies have been done on this, including 4 studies done prior to the introduction of antipsychotic drugs, showing that if you have rheumatoid arthritis, you almost never also get schizophrenia and vice versa. They're kind of mutually exclusive. Some of us in our grandiosity think that if we finally identify the cause of schizophrenia, it will also tell us a great deal about rheumatoid arthritis. And vice versa on it. One of the most interesting epidemiological things is I wrote a book called The Invisible Plague, published several years ago, which says that schizophrenia is a disease of recent origin. I really believe this. It's been almost totally ignored by my colleagues, but that's okay. Now, you would expect, they come along slowly. You would expect that there would always have been some insanity in the past just based on infections, alcohol, neurological diseases that can cause schizophrenia-like symptoms, metabolic disorders, nutritional disorders, endocrine disorders, genetic disorders like porphyria, etc. And I put all this together and estimated that you expect a baseline rate of insanity based on schizophrenia not existing, but all these other things existing, of about 0.5 insane persons per 1,000 population. I call that a baseline rate. So then I looked at 4 countries. Samuel Johnson was the first one to notice this. Of all the uncertainties of our present state, the most dreadful and alarming is the uncertain continuance of reason on it. I looked at England, Atlantic Canada, U.S., and Ireland, and looked at the rates over time from about 1800 on. One of the interesting things is that starting in the 1700s, going to Bethlehem Asylum to see the people who were insane became a big tourist attraction. In fact, here is a 1752. The same year, the hospital governing board decided to appoint the hospital porter as a constable to prevent disturbances at holiday times. The crowds continued to increase and included such individuals as the young lady who in 1752 came down from the country to see the tower, the Westminster Abbey, and Bedlam in 2 or 3 plays. So it was something you just went to as a tourist attraction. Also, Pennsylvania Hospital in 1700s, the same issue. And what I don't understand is if, in fact, insanity was at the same rate, schizophrenia insanity was at the same rate in the community then as it is now, why would it become a tourist attraction? You would have been seeing it all the time on the streets before you started to put people in the hospital. But it indeed was. Great crowds that invade the hospital give trouble and create so much disturbance, such special security precautions were instituted. The insane wing was such an object of public curiosity that the managers decided to charge an admission fee. Now, the first clear descriptions of schizophrenia are Haslam and Pinnell, almost simultaneously in England and France, and apparently independently. I've never been able to verify that because I don't speak good enough French to go back and look at the history, but apparently independently. And then from then on, the you see lots and lots. This is a chart based on the number of insane persons off the records, the public records, over time. This is the United States. Benjamin Rush, in the United States, madness has increased since 1790. These are just some quotes. Ehrmeyer Brigham, these statistics respecting insanity, although few and imperfect, show that the disease is alarmingly present in this country, especially in the northern states of the Union. That's true in those, all these early ones. It's always higher in the northern states than in the southern states on it. Also probably higher in northern Europe than southern Europe. Isaac Ray, the great prevalence of insanity, and especially its remarkable apparent increase in late years. As I say, I've got a whole book of this. This is just summarizing some of the data. Insanity is an increasing disease. Conclusion corroborates the opinion of nearly all writers, whether founded on positive or known facts, computation or on conjecture. Increase in the number of the insane has been exceptionally rapid in the last decade. Anyway, you get the idea for the United States. More than the general population, trend the census calls extraordinarily increase in the phenomenal accumulation. I'll skip over these because we're going to get to the end of time here. Then Atlantic Canada. I use Atlantic Canada because that's where I could find the best data on it. Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, PEI, New Brunswick on it. Pauper lunatics are rapidly increasing these colonies. This is Nova Scotia Lieutenant Governor, 1846. Insanity in this country is apparently on the increase. This is Henry Staub, the director of the Newfoundland Asylum. Thomas Burgeon in the Montreal Medical Journal, there's consensus of opinion that insanity is on the increase in Canada as elsewhere. Our experience certainly appears to favor the view that insanity is becoming increasingly present. That's the director of the Nova Scotia Asylum. And then just briefly in England, you get the general idea, but there's two or three here that I'll point out to you. Continually on the increase. I doubt if ever in the history of the world the experience of past ages could show a larger increase of insanity than that of the present day. John Hawkes. Oh, this is one I like. London Times, 1877. If lunacy continues to increase as at present, the insane will be in the majority, and freeing themselves will put the sane in the asylums on it. And also, this is 1898. An indiscreet statistician has quite recently, in a popular publication, computed the startling result that in AD 2301, we shall all be mad. The increasing incidence of schizophrenia has been almost completely ignored, as I mentioned, and I don't have time to go into the details on it. It's kind of an interesting history, but most of it goes back to this 1949 book by Goldhammer and Marshall, who were psychoanalysts and wanted to show that there was no increase, because if there was an increase, it wasn't consistent with psychoanalytic theory, and they did a very good job of that. And then there's also the social explanations by Fouchot, David Rothman, Andrew Scull, basically saying that there are economic and social reasons why we're putting everyone in the asylum. In fact, if you go back and look at the asylum literature, it was very hard to get in the asylum. They were all grossly overcrowded, and you had to be really sick to get yourself an asylum. The general theories that are very common today is back 100 years ago, we were putting everyone in the asylum, and if you had a troubling wife, you just kind of went down to your doc and said, hey, doc, put her away. You know, there were occasional examples of that, but they were very rare. It was really difficult to get into an asylum because as soon as they, and what I describe in the book, is you build an asylum for 300 people, it's almost immediately filled to capacity, and then there's 600 people in there, and then they build wings, and then there's 900 people, and it was quite a startling history on it. Is the incident still increasing? Apparently not. We really don't have any good data. In the United States, what data we had, we stopped collecting in the 1960s, but there's no real evidence that it has continued to increase, but there's no evidence that it's decreased either on it for the last half century. Strangers on our ability to appropriately treat schizophrenia. We tried trepanation a while back. We tried spinning chairs. We tried psychoanalytic exploration of early childhood experiences. You recognize these people. I think spinning chair probably was closer to it than that was. And because we don't understand how to treat it, we have emptied out our hospitals in the United States and also now in Canada. Canada tends to follow us, be a little bit behind us, but to make the same mistakes. We have 30% of our homeless population at a minimum are seriously mentally ill. 20% of the people in jails and prisons, a study we published last year, showed that there are about 350,000 people with severe mental illness in our jails and prisons, and we now have 35,000 people left in our state hospitals. So you have 10 times more people with severe mental illness in our jails and prisons than you have in the state hospitals. I haven't seen the data in Canada yet, but somebody should do that study up here. 1 million individuals with untreated schizophrenia have an impact on police, hospital, ERs, public parks and playgrounds, libraries, nursing homes, etc. We've done some studies on all of these things. It's a disaster, a complete disaster. Robert Reich said in 1973, freedom to be sick, helpless, and isolated is not freedom. Our present policy of discharging helpless human beings to a hostile community is immoral and inhumane. It is a return to the Middle Ages when the mentally ill roamed the streets and little boys threw rocks at them. Confusion of civil rights with common sense. The paramount civil rights of the patient should be of adequate treatment. By so doing, we will maximize our ability to assist in the attainment of the most important civil liberties that can be granted to the seriously mentally ill patient, freedom from psychosis on it. I published a book a year and a half ago now called American Psychosis, How the Federal Government Destroyed the Mental Illness Treatment System. It's subtle, but it's really a history of how we got where we are now in the United States. I'm sorry, I go back. Does anyone interested in these kinds of issues, though? We have Treatment Advocacy Center I started 15 years ago, and it just focuses on the issues of what do we do with the people if we're not treating them in the community. Now, finally, why the future looks bright. We've moved beyond 30 years of looking for bad mothers and now another 30 years of looking for bad genes. And it's clear that schizophrenia is a disease of predisposing genes, but interacting with environmental factors. And the predisposing genes are probably no more or no less important than they are for most other chronic diseases, rheumatoid, diabetes, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not a genetic disease as such. We have moved beyond our obsession with neurons and neurotransmitters. And we now realize that schizophrenia is a disease of glia and neural connections. Let me just focus on that for a minute because I think it's very important. This is what you're going to be hearing over the next 10 to 15 years is what we now are talking about, the connections. You're going to be, if you don't be teaching it already, you're going to be teaching about the superior longitudinal fasciculus, which connects the prefrontal cortex with the parietal area. The uncinate fasciculus, which connects the insula and prefrontal cortex with the superior temporal area. The arcuate fasciculus, which connects the lateral prefrontal cortex with the temporal parietal junction. These are areas that are really crucial for schizophrenia. And again, schizophrenia is not a disease of, like Parkinson's disease, which I have of, you know, particular parts of the brain. It's a network disease, and that's why it's been so difficult to focus on the parts of the brain that are, because it may well be a disease of the white matter connections equally as much, if not more so, than a disease of the neurons or the glia. And both the glia and the neurons are involved. One of the few things that we have really accomplished, I think, in recent years in brain studies of the brain is focusing on the glia as equally important to the neurons on it. The fact that we now have some of this sorted out, I think, is going to be very helpful for us. Connectome, the Human Connectome Project, which is now a big issue on the National Institute of Mental Health, is going to actually be very, very helpful in our understanding of schizophrenia on it. Some good candidates as possible environmental factors interacting with predisposing genes. immune and inflammatory markers, C-reactive protein, et cetera, which we're doing a lot of work with now. Infectious agents, this is my own research on Toxoplasma gondii especially is the infectious agent that we've been focusing on and looking at most seriously. And in fact, we're very encouraged that we're looking at something very real on it. Dietary factors in the microbiome, also very important. Last Friday, we had our decisions about funding. We fund 8 to 10 research projects on treatment, new treatments, treatments that nobody else will fund. We actually funded a project looking at fecal transplants for people with schizophrenia, which is not traditional treatment, I might say. But, you know, Freud was there. He talked about the anal stage. We're just kind of going back there. Can use new research to develop better medications. We got a large project, for example, using aspirin. Actually, aspirin is an anti-inflammatory, but just on individuals with schizophrenia who present with a very high CRP, just so that you're focusing on people with the highest marker for inflammation. Drugs to target the brain stage of Toxoplasma gondii. The cysts are in the brain stage, and we don't yet have a drug that gets into the cyst stage, but we're developing drugs along those lines. So these are the kinds of things that we're doing, which I think would be very helpful. Also, the realization that failing to treat individuals with schizophrenia is very costly. For those who are not treated, they end up being victimized, homeless, jail, etc. This is not cheap, and there's now an increased awareness, even among members of Congress, who usually are not aware of very much at all, that this is an expensive disease to not treat. And I think that any of you who are advocating treatment issues in Canada should look at the economic aspects. People in Ottawa tend to understand economic aspects where they don't understand anything else. And these are very expensive if you don't treat them at all. Congressional action, I won't go into all of this. This is actually being marked up today in Congress. The first time that Congress has actually looked seriously at mental illness laws in 50 years. Finally, we know what to do. Early treatment, greater use of clozapine. We've got a report on that coming out next week, comparing the clozapine use in different states. Use of assisted outpatient treatment, ACT programs to keep people on their medication, rehabilitation. We know what to do. Finally, it's a strange but fascinating disease. One of my favorite quotes is F. Scott Fitzgerald, who knew a lot about schizophrenia from his wife on it. Says, but the brilliance, the versatility of madness is akin to the resourcefulness of water seeping through, around, and around a dike. It requires the united front of many people to work against it. Thank you very much.
I think I used up all the time.
That's fine. Thank you. Unfortunately, we do not have time to take questions from the audience, but rest assured, Dr. Torrey will be taking questions at the banquet. So behalf on the Osler Society and the Faculties of Medicine and Social Studies of Medicine, I would like to thank Dr. Torrey for his outstanding lecture and present him with this gift. Thank you.
Of course.